Science is simultaneously celebrated, ignored, and criticized in public life. In this episode, we sit down with Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist Dan Fagan to better understand the power of science to explain the world around us, whether we like what it's telling us or not. That's this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University, alongside my friend and colleague G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Each week, we set out to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. And this week, we have some help from the Pulitzer Prize Committee and the Rhode Island Council for the Humanities, whose commemoration of the centennial of the Pulitzer Prize is exploring the changing nature of journalism and the humanities in the digital age. Their project, What is the 21st Century Essay, focuses on environmental issues because of their urgency and relevance to our health, communities, and the economy. We're grateful for their support. Our guest this week is wonderfully suited to the task. Dan Fagan is the author of Tom's River, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2014, a remarkable piece of science journalism and narrative storytelling. He's also a professor of journalism and the director of the Science, Health, and Environmental Reporting Program at New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. Dan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for the invitation.
So, you're a science journalist. How did that happen?
Oh, it happened kind of accidentally, like most things in life. I knew I wanted to be a journalist. I ever since I was a little kid, I was always interested in other people's business, and then spreading the word. For a while, I really thought I wanted to be a political reporter, and I was for a while. But I discovered I didn't really like it. It was a little bit like sports reporting. I like watching sports and playing sports, but sports journalists spend all their time writing about the game, what happened, who won, who lost. And political reporting is a lot like that, too. It's all about tactics, who's up, who's down.
The horse race.
Right, it's all about the horse race. And, of course, that's not true of all political reporting, but still, that's the bread and butter. And that gets frustrating after a while, because instead of just writing about who's winning or losing, you want to write about who's right, who's correct.
Well, so I'm curious then, sort of your thoughts on the role of journalism in American society today, and in particular, the role of the science journalist.
Well, science journalists have a really important role to play. I mean, science's gift to journalism and science journalism's gift to the rest of journalism is the idea of evidence, mm-hmm. that not all information should be equally weighted. And the scientific process is a beautiful thing because it provides a way to weigh evidence. That's not to say that individual scientists are always right. They're flawed just like the rest of us. But the scientific process is self-correcting if we apply it right. So the notion of marrying the empirical world of science with the storytelling world of narration is very powerful, very powerful. And we can bring the best of both. We can make an emotional connection to our readers through narrative, but we can also give them important information via the empiricism of science. If we can do both those things together, we've really got a powerful tool. Mm.
And I think the emotional element of that in storytelling is what sets it apart from sheer fact-based reporting, not that that isn't important as well. I want to go for a second to the larger picture again. What has changed in American journalism in the last 25 years? And we could talk at great length about that, but I wanted to just quote very briefly from your address to the 2015 World Conference of Science Journalists, where you sort of hit it on the head there. And you said, the rise of the web has crippled the revenue models that traditionally sustain newspapers, magazines, and broadcast news. American media companies that have not adapted successfully are either dying or abandoning journalism. Those that have adapted to digital models are in some cases, far too many cases, let's be frank about it, doing so in ways that make journalism increasingly difficult to practice. And then you go on to say that the general public maybe doesn't really care a lot about that. Expand on that.
It's true.
Well,
just because I said it doesn't mean that it was true. It's like a monkey with a typewriter. But I think I did get that one right, and I wasn't the only one. It's not like that was a unique insight. You know, you asked what's changed in journalism, and maybe a better question is what hasn't changed. I mean, so much has changed as we've moved to digital models. And at the beginning of that process, we thought, oh, no problem, we'll just essentially cut and paste. We'll take our print stories and just slap them online. And that is a miserable approach for multiple reasons. People don't want to read information on the web that way, number one. And number two, the business model doesn't work in the same way, if it works at all, digitally. So we need to really reinvent journalism, and we're in the process of that reinvention. It's sort of as if, you know, we're a few years after Gutenberg has perfected movable type, and the monks are in an uproar because the old ways of doing things are not working. But it's not exactly clear what the new ethics, the new models of journalism are going to be. We're still in the experimentation stage, even 15, 20 years after the sort of the shock and awe phase. So we're still figuring it out, but it's profoundly different.
So I'm wondering if I could follow up a little bit on that. So I'm curious, in that context, with all of the change that you've seen and the few things that have stayed the same, what role is there for experimentation, for self-reflection, for reinvention and innovation as a journalist working today?
Well, it's essential. It's what we desperately have to do. We know that doing things the way that we've always done them is not going to work. Here's another analogy that I like to try out. It's as if we're on a forced march to a new landscape, a new and unfamiliar landscape. And we need to adapt to that landscape. And the only way to do that kind of adaptation is to try a lot of things. And so experimentation is absolutely essential. The problem is that in a privately funded media, certainly, when the emphasis always is on short-term economic survival, it's just really hard to find the space to experiment. And so those of us who are outside the private model of journalism, it's really incumbent on us to do a lot of experimentation, to try new things, and see what works.
And the education that you're providing your students at NYU seems to be really focused on that kind of experimentation and learning, frankly, training a skill set that I'm sure you weren't prepared with when you were off as a journalist.
That's absolutely true. Our students pick up a camera. You know, they may think of themselves totally as print people, but they pick up a camera the first or second week they're with us. They podcast, they build infographics, they code, they create slideshows, they really, the whole point of storytelling now is that it should be what we call platform agnostic, which means that instead of saying, oh, I'm a print person, or oh, I'm a TV person, that's the way I tell my stories. No, what you do is you look at the story and try to find the optimal way to tell that story. And that may be it might be an infographic plus a tweet stream. It might be a 3,000 word magazine piece. But ultimately, we have an amazing variety of options, which is really exciting. We've been sort of negative here so far, but it's actually very exciting, the range of options that are available. And for students today, it's really important to expose them to all of those options.
There's no question that there is reinvention, reimagining going on. Storytelling in journalism has changed and is becoming what you say. Video is very much a part of it now. It begs a larger question, particularly in light of the 2016 election, where fake news, and I'm using that as a very general, generic term encompassing a lot of things, where fake news became an issue. And so I guess the question is, if the media reinvents and reimagines and does a better job of storytelling or a more compelling type of storytelling, Will the public care? Or have we reached a point where the distrust of media, and we see that in all kinds of research from Pew to polling, has gotten so tremendous that maybe you can't break through that, at least for a lot of people?
Well, I think that's an open question. A lot of us lose a lot of sleep thinking about that and what we can do to try to combat it, try to turn it around. It is true that public confidence in journalism is lower than it used to be. And there are a lot of reasons for that, some of them well-deserved, some of them well-earned, and some of them not. I personally think that it's most productive to focus on the things that I can change. And so I spend a lot of time thinking about what's a better way to tell this story? What's a more compelling way to tell this story? How can I reach more people with this story? Sometimes if we think too much about sort of the meta, oh my God, they don't trust us anymore, or oh my gosh, someone was just elected who tells 20 lies in a single speech, it can be paralyzing. All those things are true, and we can't forget them, but they are, it's not necessarily super productive to spend a lot of time moaning about them, and it's much more useful, I think, to think really hard about how can we tell better stories.
I think
pushing all the time for that.
I think that's a great attitude to have, because I think as when you're in the media, it can be very, very tempting to just kind of throw up your arms and say, we've lost the battle. And you're absolutely right, because there is separate research that shows that compelling stories in whatever medium do get an audience, and that audience can grow. And so it comes back again to the storytelling and the quality of it.
Yeah, and it's also true, I think, in our constant doomsaying, we lose sight of the fact that more people are reading our work than ever before. Our audiences are bigger than ever. We have the ability to hear from our readers in ways that we haven't before. And sure, sometimes we get plenty of trolls, but we also get plenty of folks who think our work is really impactful. I mean, I hear from people every week, multiple people now. It's been 3 years since that book came out, and I hear from people constantly about how it's affected them, and that is a reminder to me of the power of storytelling. Storytelling is still powerful, and we can't forget that.
You've observed in other places that in an age, ironically, where we have so much access to information, there's actually less, it seems, journalism. Why is journalism and why are journalists so important in this information-rich environment when anybody can go out and Google, you know, epidemiology?
Right. Well, you've hit it on the head that it's true. Sometimes, you know, people are quick to say when Donald Trump gets elected, people say, well, journalism didn't do its job. And I would be the first to say that there are many things about how the journalism of the past year unfolded that if I could wave a wand, I would change. But it's also true that journalism is just one voice. It's just one voice in a cacophony of spin and marketing and commercial messages. What makes journalism different, what sets it apart, are really a few things. One is the core principle of verification, that this is verified information, or it should be. That's really important, and that's not something that you see in marketing and other kinds of spin campaign ads. Secondly, is the idea of context, that we're not just going to give you a little squib of information, we're going to tell you where it fits, how it fits into the big picture. That's essential. And third is we're going to think really hard about the story, about the narrative. Really, only journalism does that. And the other difference with journalism is that the best journalism puts the needs of the reader, the listener, the viewer first. Mm. No other kind of communication does that. Every other kind of communication is designed to sell something or to sway your opinion. Journalism, done right, says no. We're not interested in that. I mean, there's opinion journalism. That's a different matter. Mm-hmm. But straight journalism says no. What we are going to do is we're going to think really carefully about the needs of a reader. What does our audience need to be well-informed citizens of a democracy? No one else does that. And that's why journalism is so important, really more important than ever.
We're going to take a quick moment here for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, a weekly effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. I'm Jim Lutis alongside G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. You can listen to Story in the Public Square four times each week on Sirius XM satellite radio channel 124, the POTUS channel. Our guest this week is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Tom's River, Dan Fagan. I want to bring Wayne back into this.
I want to hear about Tom's River.
Okay.
It won a Pulitzer Prize. It obviously was a tremendous piece of storytelling. I believe the committee said, for handling, quote, topics of great complexity with the dexterity of a scholar, the honesty of a journalist, and the dramatic skill of a novelist. High praise. Tell us about the book.
Thanks. Just slight clarification. That comment was actually from a wonderful author named Sid Mukherjee, who wrote The Emperor of All Maladies. Mm-hmm. He very kindly blurred my book, and
I'm sure the
committee was, the Pulitzer committee was very nice also.
But I'm sure they agreed, or they wouldn't have given you the prize.
I hope they did agree.
So tell us about the book.
So Tom's River, like a lot of things that work out well, was not planned necessarily. It wasn't part of some, you know, life strategy. It really arose out of my frustrations as a daily newspaper reporter at Newsday. I covered the environment for many years for Newsday, the Long Island newspaper. We also sold a lot of papers in New York City too. And if you cover the environment in the suburbs or the city, you really spend a lot of time writing about environmental health, because we don't have a lot of wide open spaces. We don't have antelope dancing across the plains. So, and when you're writing about environmental health, you're really writing about patterns of illness. And I would constantly hear from people, why are so many people sick on my block? Why are so many people getting cancer in the post office where I work? And I thought that was really interesting. And so I got interested in the twin disciplines of toxicology, which is the science of poisons, of things that can hurt you, and epidemiology, which is the study of patterns of illness over space and time. And I wrote a lot of stories about that on Long Island, and they got a lot of attention. And the National Cancer Institute came in and did a big study, but I didn't think it was a very good study, and the results were ambiguous, because it wasn't well planned, in my opinion. So I started looking around for other places that were doing it right, and I heard about this situation in a town on the Jersey Shore where a really interesting piece of science was underway, and I went down and wrote a story about it and met some of the key people, and I told myself, this would be a great book. This would be a great book if I ever get a chance to write it. And then a few years later, I had been a part-time teacher at NYU. I took a full-time job there and started looking around for a book, and immediately thought of Tom's River. So that was the genesis of the project.
You mentioned that epidemiology is really about patterns. The public can see patterns in a lot of different things. And sometimes, as I think you said elsewhere, that those patterns are misinterpreted. And we wind up with hysteria over something like vaccinations, because somebody saw something, reported it, and repeated it, and then it takes on. That's a powerful example of story in the public square. How do we make sure that stories that are founded on science have the traction that they need to meet sort of that initial reaction that, well, everybody I know, you know, X number of people have had this reaction when they had that shot, so there must be a pattern there.
Right.
How do you confront that?
Right. That's a really good question, and that's sort of at the core of the book. It's not really so much that people misreport patterns of illness. It's that they overinterpret them sometimes. They see a pattern, And there may well be an unusually high number of cases in a particular place. But the key question is it a non-random pattern? And there's only one way to figure that out, and that's through the science and the mathematics of epidemiology. And even then, we will never know for sure. But we can come up, you know, using a whole series of statistical calculations that have been developed over a period of a couple hundred years, we can come up with a pretty good idea of whether this pattern that we see is just bad luck or whether it really does suggest that something specific is going on there to cause an unusual number of illnesses. So, but your point is a really good one, and that is that for journalists, we need to understand that when we write about patterns of illness, we need to make sure that we're talking to the right people and that we are not over-interpreting that information. We need to make sure that we're going step by step and explaining what's happening, but also putting it in the correct scientific context. And that's where working science into your story is so incredibly important.
Do you accept or believe that regardless of how good your journalism is, you personally and other science journalists, that there is an audience that will never be convinced of the science? And we can use many examples from climate change to vaccines, as Jim mentioned, and there are many, many more. You know, we live in a country where creationism is still taught in some schools, in a country where for religious purposes and religious beliefs, some people still think the world was created in 7 days or 6 days and then God rested on the seventh. Do you accept that you're not going to change those minds or some of those minds?
I don't think it's up to me to say I accept it or I don't accept it. Mm. You know, I would never judge my success as a journalist by saying, well, does everyone believe what I write? I judge my success as a journalist by whether I have gotten close to depicting, as close to depicting reality as I possibly can. You know, there's been a huge amount of social science research done over the last 10 or 15 years about why people believe what they believe. And that we could have a whole 2-hour discussion about that. And
it's quite a 30-minute show. So.
Well, I'll spare you the details.
You're welcome to come back.
I'll come back.
Okay.
But it's quite fascinating. And basically, if I could just summarize it in 60 seconds, it's that people are open to new ideas for a while. Especially when they're young, and especially when those ideas don't contradict their worldview, their sense of what team they're on. But when once a person and once an idea, like say your attitude toward climate change, has acquired a kind of cultural resonance that it becomes a way to define who you are, I'm on Team Red, so of course my attitude is skeptical toward the science of climate change. Once an issue reaches that level, then we run into exactly what you're explaining, which is that people are unconvincible. I don't worry overly about that.
So what do you do? And I don't mean you. What does society do when those kinds of beliefs stop clear efforts to ameliorate or change? And I'm thinking politics now. We have an administration coming in that does not appear to be the most environmentally friendly administration. What does society have as a responsibility to address that? Because that's where the rubber meets the road.
Let me, if I could also sort of piggyback on that a little bit too, to ask, what is the role of the citizen in understanding, or what is the responsibility of the citizen in understanding the science that is driving these conversations?
Yeah. Well, those are both really, really deep questions. I guess to begin with the idea of the citizen, yes, a democracy requires a literate, well-informed citizenry that has an open mind to do information. That is not always the citizenry that we get, certainly not 100% of it. Not by a long shot. Again, that sort of very Jeffersonian ideal conflicts with the reality of what we know about how people formulate their beliefs and stick to those beliefs. So again, I don't spend a lot of time trying to hector my readers, you know, why don't you believe me? Why don't you believe this? I find that not at all productive. What is productive is for me to think really carefully about what is the best way for me to reach those folks with good, accurate information that perhaps they will consider. Again, there's been a lot of thinking about this, and one way, it's really more relevant for persuaders than it is for journalists. But one way is to think about how to reach people with information about climate change, for example, that doesn't conflict with their core beliefs. That says, here's some information, and you can accept this information, and you don't have to repudiate who you are. That's really important.
There's actually been some interesting research on this point that if you're talking to somebody who's entrenched in a belief system, the facts will never persuade them.
Well, the facts will never persuade them to abandon their belief system. But that doesn't mean that their belief system is not sufficiently malleable mm-hmm. that they can take new information on board. It all depends on how it's presented. Now, for journalists, this presents some real challenges because, again, I'm from the school that says our goal is not to persuade you. I don't consider my work to be a success if I get a bill passed or if I get 1,000 people to sign a petition. That is not how I judge the success of my work. I judge the success of my work by one criteria, well, two really. One is, have I come as close to depicting reality as possible? And two, have I reached a lot of people? Mm-hmm. Because I'm a journalist, and if no one is reading my work, then I've wasted my time.
Well, and you're a remarkable journalist at that. Dan Fagan, thank you so much for being with us. The book is Tom's River. I recommend it highly. I'm Jim Lutis with G. Wayne Miller. If you like Story in the Public Square, you can learn more by following us on Facebook and Twitter or by visiting pellcenter.org. We'll be back next week and hope you will be too. Thanks for joining us.